Welcome to the Federal Societies Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Societies Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, January 18, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Societies special Courthouse Steps telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing this morning's Supreme Court oral arguments in Lee v. Tam. My name is Nate Kazmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are pleased to have with us Megan Brown, who is a partner at Wiley Rain LLP, and Dwayne Sam, who is an associate at Wiley Rain LLP. I will turn it over to Ms. Brown to get us started. After opening remarks, we will go to audience question and answer. Thank you both for speaking with us. Megan, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you so much. Dwayne and I are really happy to be here. We've been involved in this case, Lee versus Tam, for amici in both the Federal Circuit and in a related case that is in the Fourth Circuit brought involving pro football, which folks know as the Redskins litigation involving cancellation. This case involves the constitutionality of a part of Section 2A of the longstanding Lanham Act, which governs federal registration of trademarks. Federal registration of trademarks affords a bevy of protections that augment sort of the common law trademark protections. And everyone in the case agrees that there are benefits from federal trademark registration. The way this case arose is Simon Tam formed an Asian rock band called The Slants and sought to get a trademark for the name of the band so he could use it on t-shirts and records and such. And the trademark office decided that his use of the word The Slants in context was disparaging to a subset of Asian Americans who would take offense and feel disparaged by the use of the word slant. They relied on a variety of types of evidence from some dictionaries, slang dictionaries and others, internet searches, to conclude that, you know, this is likely to be disparaging to that subset and therefore denied registration. Tam has spent several years litigating against the trademark office. He achieved a sort of coup in the federal circuit when, after a negative panel decision, the en banc federal circuit sua sponte granted rehearing. And what had happened was he lost at the panel. The trademark office was affirmed based on a 30-year-old case called In re McGinley. But a judge on the panel wrote a very long concurring opinion, if memory serves, that took issue with that decision and called effectively for review to harmonize that case law with modern First Amendment jurisprudence that says you can't pick and choose the beneficiaries of government benefits or government discretion based on the viewpoint expressed or the content of the speech, saying that, you know, this really is core protected First Amendment activity. Trademarks are, many of them are inherently expressive or at best mixed with commercial speech. And therefore, the government does not have the discretion, free from First Amendment scrutiny or review, to say, we don't like what you have to say because we think it might offend folks, some subset of folks. And the en banc federal circuit took the case and invalidated the disparagement bar of the Lanham Act. So the Supreme Court granted cert, not surprisingly, given the invalidation of a longstanding federal statute, just for procedural context so folks understand where this case is in relation to the Redskins case. The Redskins were involved in a cancellation suit by Ms. Blackhorse, who sought to have their many trademarks for the Redskins canceled on the disparagement grounds. Their case involves a variety of additional arguments like due process and certain claims like that, but it raises a lot of the same core issues. Their attorneys tried to get cert granted in the case, but it has not yet been argued at the Fourth Circuit, so it is now being held. The Supreme Court didn't take it up with the Tam case, although it does raise very similar issues just from the cancellation perspective. So lots of amicus briefs were filed in this case. The core of the issue really comes down to, is the trademark regime the kind of government program or government initiative that enables the government to pick and choose. The government's brief takes a pretty strident view that this is government speech under a doctrine that was pretty recently created in a case called Pleasant Grove versus Summum, in which the court said public land where people are going to put monuments, the government doesn't have to take all monuments. That's government speech. They can decide what speech to associate with. That case was recently extended in the Walker case involving the Confederate license plate program, where the court, over some dissents, found that the Texas vanity license plate program was government speech. The government has used that doctrine here very aggressively in TAM to say that the trademark regime itself is a government program that entitles it to pick and choose what to associate with virtually without First Amendment scrutiny. So a lot of the briefing involved that. I did not attend argument. Dwayne did. To set the stage, the government is trying to save the Lanham Act from invalidation. Numerous amici were filed on both sides, joining several of these issues, including are trademarks expressive activity? Is this like Rust versus Sullivan and some of the longstanding spending clause cases that allow the government to restrict the participation in a program? Or is this the government really trying to pick and choose based on viewpoint and content that goes too far? So with that, I will turn it over to Dwayne, who was in the courtroom this morning, to share some thoughts on what how the justices reacted and what we might be able to expect on the government speech doctrine and others.
Thanks, Megan. I think probably makes the most logical place to start on me to talk about the government's arguments. And for those that have filed the case in the lower courts or have read some of the briefing, true to form, the government's argument today hewed very closely to its brief. Its main points were that Section 2A only regulates the commercial aspects of speech and it does not prohibit expression. I thought that was telling because its opening argument or its leading argument was not that the trademark regime is quintessential government speech. But just to go back to its leading point, the government essentially argued that it's not doing anything to stop the band members from speaking or calling themselves anything they want. You know, as the government sees it, you know, to the extent that it's going to give its imprimatur to a name, the law appropriately forbids disparagement. And that's about as much that the government got out before it started getting peppered by questions from the justices. Justice Kennedy in particular raised the question as to whether or not such a regime of disparagement clause could exist in the copyright regime. And Justice Alito also expressed sort of his incredulity that the government wasn't willing to sort of cede that ground, at least in its briefing. And he also queried whether it were possible to separate the commercial versus the expressive nature of the mark. Justice Breyer chimed in with questions regarding whether the disparagement clause furthers the ultimate purpose of the registration scheme, which in his view was to identify the source of the product. Justice Kagan, from the inception, was of the view that this was sort of hallmark viewpoint discrimination and really engaged in an extended colloquy with counsel regarding why this was not viewpoint discrimination and reiterated several times that the government programs cannot make distinctions based on the viewpoint. Justice Ginsburg also chimed in and really helped to pivot the discussion that at least initially was dominated by the discussion regarding viewpoint and brought up the issue regarding vagueness and just pointed to one of the marks in particular. I think she referenced Heath and noted that there have been instances when that mark has been approved and instances where that mark has been rejected. And, you know, you bringing that up to point out that, well, look, I mean, this is a vague statute. And counsel responded by noting that, well, you know, when you're looking at the review of tens of thousands of applications, it's sort of expected that you're going to have some inconsistencies. Justice Sotomayor, for her part, she retorted that that's just another way of saying that the statute is so unclear that it's difficult to get it right.
And just to expand on that, I'll interrupt, Dwayne. The briefs I commend to your attention several of the amicus briefs, mine and ours included, for the Rutherford Institute and Consumers Research, but Pro Football filed one. They're colorful reads. They're not what I would have my, you know, teenage child read. The registration of trademarks that are both offensive and colorful is hardly new. There are many trademarks that are that range from the silly to the asinine to the truly offensive, depending on your standard, your personal standard of decency. So I'm glad Sotomayor pointed that out. Sorry to interrupt.
Sure, no worries. Ginsburg was also the only justice, interestingly, that brought up the other provisions in Section 2A, namely the immoral and scandalous clauses in Section 2A, and queried whether the court's analysis or TAMP's counsel thought that the that his arguments also were dispositive as to those issues as well. The court did not engage in any sort of extended discussion regarding that, but I thought it was interesting nonetheless. Obviously, that was not the question that was before the court, but it is certainly telling in terms of just where Justice Ginsburg's thinking may be. Something also of note, just in terms of assessing counsel for Tam and his arguments, it was interesting that he did not appear willing to cede any ground as well. It was clear that there seemed to be at least a majority view that this was at the very least viewpoint discrimination. But then when sort of pressed further, I think it was Justice Kennedy that posed the question to Tam's counsel as to whether the court should view the trademark regime as essentially a public park. Tam's counsel took that bait, and that's where things started to go a bit downhill on his side. And, I think it was Justice Kagan that sort of pointed out the illogic of that argument, that this could not possibly be viewed as a public park because there are any number of historically proscribed types of speech that the government could prescribe in the trademark regime, libel, pornography, and those sorts of things. And it didn't seem as though TAMP's counsel was willing to at least concede that the government, at least for that narrow set of speech that has been historically prescribed, that the government could also ban trademark registrations on that basis.
Yeah, it's a question a lot of reporters have asked and others have asked, sort of, does this mean that the trademark office will have to register all kinds of really gross pictures and words? And it seems entirely possible that Congress could rectify the statute by adding some limitations for the truly troubling outlier cases to the extent they fall within categories of unprotected speech, like obscenity, libel, et cetera. But that's not how the case has been framed up thus far.
It was interesting, too, that going back to the first point that Justice Kennedy raised regarding whether and to what extent this was like the copyright regime, I think there was consensus on both sides that although trademarks can be used as a vehicle for expression, that historically that trademarks have not been the forum or the choice forum for expressive activity. And Justice, I believe it was Justice Alito, was the biggest proponent of the idea in at least getting the government to concede that trademarks can be used for expressive purposes. But again, the government circled back to the idea that this was not the historical basis. So ultimately, there's sort of that looming question and the obvious nexus regarding the Redskins case. Tellingly, that did not come up directly, but the implications, I think, are obvious for that case as well. To the extent that the court were to decide to affirm the Federal Circuit in striking down the disparagement clause of Section 2A, presumably that would make the Redskins' road to having the EDBA decision overturned that much easier. But it's always difficult to tell with these things. It's often, my view is that it's sort of a fool's errand to try to predict where the court is going to go or how the justices are going to rule. It certainly seemed as though there was a dominant view that this was viewpoint discrimination at the very least. And certainly, Ginsburg brought up the vagueness issue, but you know, Justice Thomas, you know, ever the taciturn justice, didn't say anything at all. So it's hard to tell where he is going to fall on the issue. And Sotomayor, Justice Sotomayor as well, didn't engage too much in the colloquy. So it's still sort of up in the air to see ultimately where how the court will rule.
I think with that, we're perfectly willing to take questions. Again, not going to prognosticate, although, you know, several recent Supreme Court cases have shown a sort of philosophical approach to vindicating the First Amendment as a restriction on government. A couple terms ago, the USAID case, which involved a spending condition, was a victory for First Amendment principles that restrict government discretion. So it wouldn't surprise me to see those ideas come over here. And I'm also looking to see whether the government speech doctrine, newly minted, gets curtailed in some way. The timing of the EDVA decision in the pro football case was notable. If I recall, it was, I think that decision came out of the district court 2 weeks after Walker, and the case had not been briefed as a government speech case, but Judge Lee took the government speech doctrine from Walker and used it to resoundingly uphold the government's discretion here. And I think that doctrinal innovation, you know, the doctrine's not beloved on the court. It's not long on the court. And it was concerns were raised about it by Justice Ginsburg and others when it was minted. I'll be curious to see if in the writing, the justices do something to throw a little cold water on the government's enthusiasm for the government speech doctrine. So I guess with that, Nick, if folks have questions or you have anything, you know, we're happy to chat.
Very good. Let's move to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter star, then the pound sign. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. One question that I had is, you know, the Lanham Act has been on the books for many decades. Do you all have an assessment as to why the disparagement bar is only being challenged now?
Well, I think, you know, if you go back and look historically, it was really the Henry McGinley decision that sort of set the tone and the tempo for where the statute would end up. And it was really the predecessor courts of the Federal Circuit, their upholding of Section 2A that has allowed Section 2A to thrive for all these years. And the court really took sort of an uncritical view of the statute and really just sort of held without any analysis that Section 2A does not implicate the First Amendment at all, that it doesn't have anything to do with speech. And I think it was because of that decision that that's really what got us here today. It wasn't until the Federal Circuit revisited the issue in Henry Tam and ultimately overturned Henry McGinley that really allowed this decision to come before the court today.
Okay, very good. Currently, our audience question queue is wide open. If you'd like to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign. One programming note, our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for next Tuesday, the 24th at 1 p.m. That call will be the second annual Mike Lewis Memorial Teleform. That call will feature Stephen Bradbury, who is a partner at Deckert LLP, Philip Carter from the Center for a New American Security, and Adam Klein, also from the Center for a New American Security. Okay, looks like we have one question waiting. Again, if you'd like to get in the queue, please enter star, then the pound sign. Let's go to our first audience question of the day.
Good afternoon. My name's Renee, and I am calling just curious. I know that we are all missing the absence of Justice Scalia. Any sense at all of, you know, how he may have weighed in on this issue? And or, you know, what we might have expected in terms of questioning?
You know, I think he would have been, you know, it's always hard to predict, to, you know, prognosticate a little bit on what he would have done. Certainly he's an absence up there. And I think in a case like this would have been an aggressive questioner. I tend to think he would have shared some skepticism of the government's hubris may be too strong a word, but its defense of its need to protect folks from offense, that, you know, the idea that the trademark, the denial of registration of a trademark is actually going to be effective in protecting people from offense, given the, you know, the robust marketplace of ideas, is a little silly and might have drawn his ire, as well as, you know, this use of the trademark regime to disfavor certain views. But beyond that, it's hard to say, you know, he was on the right side or the winning side of those recent First Amendment cases that make me think that the structural limitation of the First Amendment as a check on government power would be one with which he would have sympathized.
Thanks.
Thanks, Renee.
Okay, we have two people currently waiting to ask a question. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Michelle Roberts calling in. Were there any other Supreme Court cases that the parties or the justices referred to in arguments other than Sons of Confederate Veterans?
There was the Pacifica case that Justice Breyer brought up in making a point that he thought the trademark regime was analogous to time, place, and manner restriction. That is, you know, his view was that, you know, potential prospect of registrants have the entire world, or you know, I think the analogy that he made was that, look, there are 10,000 billboards, and all we're saying is that there's this one billboard where prospective registrants sort of have to abide by very specific time, place, and manner restrictions. And he brought up the Pacifica case to make that point. It was a curious take on the case, and it wasn't immediately clear that Tam's counsel was seemed ready to respond to that time, place, and manner argument, but that was the only other case that was really brought up clearly.
And just to flesh out a bit of the government's sort of point there, in the briefs, they make a big deal about having to publish these words in the register and issue certificates of trademark, kind of like the patent certificates you get. You can get a certificate of a trademark registration with the seal of the United States. And they also publish a list that they have to send to foreign governments. And those are sort of the three things that they invoke, that the government invokes to say, these are expressive activities of the government and in which we do not want to associate with or tolerate the injection of offensive or disparaging material. It's not, to my personal view and those of my clients, it's not the same as a public park outside of City Hall or really the license plate registration scheme. And there's some tension where the government's arguing that, but at the same time in the past has argued that trademark registration is not an endorsement or an imprimatur. In fact, the register is full of ridiculous trademarks that no one believes the register, the head of the trademark office is endorsing. Our brief cites, you know, Catholics for Choice, Trump's Make America Great Again, a bunch of things that I don't feel comfortable saying in public, and a lot of other trademarks that no one really thinks the government is endorsing, you know, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, any number of things. So there's, to me, a little tension in the government pushing too hard on that.
Okay, very good. Let's go to our next caller.
Yes, it's David Emerson, Federalist Society member here in Berkeley, California. You know, I apologize if I tuned in a little bit late, so this may have been covered already. But I wanted to ask a question about whether or not there was any discussion, at least in this case, or just to whether the panelists have any discomforts in general, on whether limitations in other related areas of intellectual property, for example, copyright limitations and patent limitations, both as to subject matter and content, as a matter of fact, against public policy, have any analog here in the trademark space. And for example, although I don't have the statute in front of me right now, creating a patent for something which is designed for criminal activities would be against public policy and likely be declined. And also, I believe in the copyright area, there are also areas that are carved out which are against public policy. So my question is, is there any useful analog for these other two areas of intellectual property to be brought to light on this case?
There were not any public policy discussions regarding some of the analogous areas of intellectual property like copyright, but again, you know, I thought it was telling that Justice Kennedy, right out of the gate, sort of stressed that he did not think that a disparagement clause would have any purchase in the copyright regime. And you know, Alito sort of piggybacked on that that issue, and eventually got the government's counsel to concede, which it did not do in its briefing, that you just couldn't have a disparagement clause in the copyright regime, particularly because copyrights are, you know, historically viewed as an expressive form and an expressive vehicle. And so that was really the extent of the discussion in terms of drawing analogies between trademark and other forms of intellectual property.
And I think with respect to the patent question, I think that would be pretty far removed from expressive activity. I don't know the contours of those public policy limitations. I can imagine there are probably many. But I don't, it's not an expressive forum on the spectrum of copyright, trademark, and then patent.
Okay, very good. Let's go to our next caller.
Okay. Oh, good afternoon. My name is Lou Smith. I'm a Federalist Society member. And I had a question in regard to the disparaging speech part of this. Hasn't the government in this case committed prior censorship? Don't they have to have some proof that there has been a somebody's been disparaged by this T-shirt?
I think your question goes to what sort of evidence is needed, and I think that's, you know, the Trademark Office has a test that they use. It tends to still be fairly subjective. They would say they have evidence that this is disparaging to the subset of people in the class, the group of Asians. Whether, you know, whether that's constitutionally adequate to justify restrictions, that's implicit in this case, I guess. I find it notable Tam did not bring a case, you know, it wasn't just he's gone at the full First Amendment invalidate the statute as opposed to just they got my case wrong, there's not enough evidence. So the PTO can make fact-based determinations. The United States brief did invoke Chevron deference in its reply brief on its creation of a standard for what disparagement actually means, but there are some uncomfortable different results that seem to arise from the subjectivity inherent in this. So I think your point goes at that question, which is how much evidence, you know, on what basis should the government be allowed to do this? And they would say they have a robust record.
Yeah, for sure. You know, if you take a look at the record that was established below before the trademark board, both sides really marshaled, you know, tons of evidence that, you know, it was disparaging to a certain subset or composite of the Asian community. And, you know, Mr. Tam, for his part, he marshaled evidence, conducted surveys and got signatures and, you know, really the whole nine. So there was evidence on both sides. Ultimately, the government decided to do what it wanted, really, and to, you know, disallow that particular mark.
And I think it goes to a question that was certainly part of our briefs at the lower court level about the government's discretion. I think it's in our brief here a bit. Cato referenced this as well. The government's point that there's 300,000 applications for trademarks and occasionally erroneous registrations slip through, that sort of proves the idea that there's a lot of discretion here. When you're a government employee, and I don't doubt that they're operating in good faith and they're working really hard and they're getting lots of applications, you're sort of left to their gut reactions to see what strikes them as disparaging and what gets pulled out of the pile to be subjected to this more searching review. Does a trademark get third parties that weigh in on it? and choose to go after one sort of disfavored perspective or disfavored mark that, due to the breadth and the crush of the work, means that certain viewpoints are more likely to get singled out for disfavored treatment. And then if you're going to fight the government on this, I mean, Simon Tam has been fighting for, I think it's 6 years over this case. How many small entrepreneurs, artists, and otherwise have the resources and the commitment to try and fight these kinds of cases? So to me, it sort of goes back to the question of discretion, vagueness, and is this really something we want federal government employees sort of, you know, taking a look at and making a judgment call about what bothers them or what they think would bother someone else?
And, you know, just to comment a little bit further on just how murky or nebulous the evidentiary standard is, in the record before the trademark board, they actually took a look at discussion boards and comments that were posted in discussion boards as part of the body of evidence to determine whether the slants was disparaging to the Asian American community. So it's not at all clear, you know, that certainly isn't a limiting factor. And it just, you know, again, goes to show that, you know, that it was really sort of a vague standard upon which the government based its decision.
And it really gives the lie to, if you're an unpopular speaker, you could get overwhelmed at the trademark office with adverse evidence and be unable to produce evidence on your side. And is that really how we want First Amendment protections to work, which is to make a speaker have to carry that burden to rebut what others could put in or what a bureaucrat in the PTO finds online, just to have their First Amendment rights protected? It's a daunting task to fight the PTO. It necessarily, in many briefs, gets pointed out that will have a chilling effect as people try and decide what am I going to name my band? Is it worth it to push the envelope? I want to do this or I want to do that, but I think the government's going to get mad at me. That sort of uncertainty and uphill climb will logically have a chilling effect on what people want to pursue.
Okay, unfortunately today our speakers are working on a shortened time frame, so this will be our last call of the day. We're going to try to squeeze it in and then let them get on with the rest of their busy day. So last caller of the day right here.
You know, when you look at the list of amicus briefs, it's clear to me that a lot of parties look upon this as a proxy for the Redskins case that's not yet ripe for consideration. But you indicated that during oral argument, the Redskins case didn't even come up. Do you think that the Federal Circuit's decision, unprecedented decision to sua sponte, reconsider this decision, was based upon the fact that the Redskins case is out there as well?
You know, I'm thinking back to the briefing and the panel decision in the Federal Circuit case, and I don't think that they did it as a response to or a way to prejudge the Redskins case. I think, you know, you can't help but know that that's out there, and that there is an increasing effort to use the trademark registration regime as a way to weigh in on speech issues and viewpoints. I think that certainly wasn't missed by them. The Redskins briefing was, I think, influential in some of the on-bank opinion writing, so I think they were certainly aware of it. But the tone of, if I recall, Judge Moore's opinion from the panel really was a call to revisit their own precedent of In re McGinley, which had sort of nationally chilled the ability to really quarrel with the disparagement bar. And I think they did it to get their own house in order and really to modernize the Lanham Act in light of, you know, what's a pretty robust innovations or development of First Amendment jurisprudence in the past 30 to 40 years. Dwayne?
And I would just add that I think that all of the parties involved have really made a concerted effort to distinguish and separate and not really align themselves with the Redskins case. You know, you take a look at Mr. Tam, for example, has disavowed, you know, the Redskins position and Dan Snyder's position as owner of the Redskins. The Supreme Court declined to accept counsel Lisa Blatt's petition to sort of join the consolidated petitions and join with the Tam case. The court wanted to keep those separate. And I think one of the reasons is because, you know, the Redskins arguably may be a less sympathetic case, you know, whereas Tam is more so dealing with reappropriating creation, that's not the case with the Redskins. So I think there have been clear efforts to sort of keep those two separate.
Okay, very good. Any additional comments or concluding remarks that you both would like to make?
No, I think we've covered it. Thank you for the opportunity to share our perspective.
Well, I think you've covered it very well. And on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank both Megan Brown and Dwayne Sam for speaking with us today. We welcome listener feedback at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.